Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. A new analysis finds that each great whale in the ocean is worth $2 million, not only because they are the source of tourism revenue, but because they are an important part of enabling the ocean to produce more food and store more carbon. As they swim around the ocean eating and then relieving themselves, they move nutrients. And then when they die, they take those nutrients and all the carbon they've amassed over a lifetime to the bottom of the ocean with them. Blue whales are the largest of all the whales, growing up to 100 feet and close to 200 tons. My next guest has been studying a unique population of blue whales, those that live near Sri Lanka. Asha DeVos is founding executive director of Ocean Swell. Asha, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
Asha, obviously a lot of people love whales. They find them charismatic and lovable. Make the case that they're ecologically important. What do whales do for the ecosystems that they're part of?
Well, I mean, I love that this is where we're starting off because it is an important topic of conversation for me. So whales are beautiful and charismatic and all of the above, but I think if we love them for just that reason, we're doing them an injustice because they are what we call ecosystem engineers. So basically, whales dive to the depths to feed. And in these cold, dark places where you and I can't swim freely, there are these nutrients like iron and nitrogen that are limiting from in the surface water. So they're actually not really readily available in the surface waters. So they dive to these areas, they feed on what they're feeding on, and in the process consume all these nutrients. And then they come up to the surface to breathe, as they do, as they're mammals. And as they come up to the surface, they basically poop, right? So there are these giant fecal plumes that they release. And now these fecal plumes are chock full of these nutrients. There's these tiny microscopic plants called phytoplankton that are waiting for these nutrients. And then they use the sunlight nutrients and put them together and they photosynthesize and they produce oxygen, right? So 50 to 70% of the oxygen we breathe is actually produced in the oceans. And at least a part of it is fertilized by whale poop, which is a really good case for caring for them beyond just their beauty. And then on top of that, you know, the whale carcasses are a really, really important food supply for many organisms, not just on the surface waters. As soon as they die, they float for a little bit. Basically, lots of species like sharks will come and take bites off them. But then as these carcasses start to sink into the depths, it's actually called whale fall. So they sink to the deepest parts of our oceans where there's not a lot of sunlight at all. And so there's not a lot of like food production. And when it sinks and it settles on the seafloor, there are many organisms down there that basically just go in for the feast. So they're important from that point of view as well, because they provide food to a lot of different species. And as this whale fall sinks, it actually traps carbon in the carcass, and it sinks to the depths of our oceans, which we consider our greatest carbon sink. So it's a space which traps excess carbon dioxide from the environment, therefore buffering us from even worse climate change impacts.
Asha DeVos, I'm guessing that you did not grow up saying, I am going to study whale poop. How did you get here? How did you first get interested in whales, at least?
So I would say, you know, I grew up with very non-conventional pets. I have an older brother. The two of us, we had caterpillars and scorpions and grasshoppers in our bedroom. So praise to my parents for tolerating that, really.
For sure.
And yeah, so for us, you know, we grew up, you know, I grew up in the tropics. I'm from Sri Lanka. So I had the opportunity of basically just having nature in my home and being part of nature very fully. And I think that's sort of where my first love for the environment started. I then, at about six, my parents used to bring home these National Geographic magazines, and I would look through these pages and think, wow, like, who are these people? Where are they going? I want to go where no one else will ever go and see things no one else will ever see. And so I would like almost replace those faces with my own, even though none of the people in the magazine at that time looked like me in any way or form, right? But it was my childhood audacity that allowed me to believe that it was possible. And as I grew up, you know, I fell in love with water. My parents exposed me to interesting people. One of my mentors was Sir Arthur C. Clarke, and he wrote 2001 Space Odyssey. He's one of the fathers of satellite technology. He moved to Sri Lanka from the UK. I think it's because of the weather, but he says it's for diving. And so he moved there for this amazing diving, and he would tell me these amazing stories. And then I'm telling people, Sri Lankans, I'm like, I'm going to be a marine biologist. I'm going to go to university, and that's what I'm going to study. And they were just like, what are you going to do with that degree?
So how did you decide what to do with that degree? I mean, why not simply go join an established marine biological research organization somewhere in the world? Instead, you chose to found Sri Lanka's first marine conservation research group, Oceanswell. Why did you feel that's what you needed to do?
So I only left Sri Lanka because I couldn't study to be a marine biologist there. My intention was to go away, learn, create opportunities for myself, but also create a platform and a network that will allow me to create opportunities for others. And I was always going to move back home. I was always going to serve my country. There was no question about that. I mean, I genuinely believe Sri Lanka is an incredible country with enormous potential and some amazing talent. And that's what I wanted to unearth for the world.
Well, one of the flagship projects of Oceanswell is the Sri Lankan Blue Whale Project, a long-term study of blue whales. I mean, I guess if you're really going to go for it, go big and have fun, right? Why study just any whale when you could study the biggest of all the whales, right? But you call the blue whales the unorthodox whales. I mean, presumably they're doing this whole thing of eating and pooping and eventually dying and falling to the bottom like other whales are. What makes them so unorthodox?
Yeah, so this particular population in Sri Lanka. So I my story is, I tell people that my Eureka moment happened when I encountered an aggregation of blue whales and a floating pile of whale poop, right? And so the reason that was my Eureka moment is because, first of all, there was basically no work done on blue whales in the waters around Sri Lanka until I started this project. So I pioneered the research on blue whales in the whole region. And my Eureka moment was really that moment where I saw these blue whales. I expected them to be breeding and calving because, you know, you think about the traditional large whale model. They go to cold places where they feed, and then they go to warm places where they breed and calve. And so when I saw this aggregation in Sri Lankan waters, we're 5 degrees above the equator. It's beautiful and tropical and warm. I was like, for sure, there's like mating going on and there's calves, right? And that's not what I saw. But instead, I was presented by these very generous whales with a gigantic pile of whale poop, right? And I saw it and I thought to myself, well, that's kind of weird, right? Like, they're not supposed to be feeding here, which means they shouldn't be pooping. But that was the point when I realized that, well, maybe not all whales do the same thing, you know? And clearly they figured out how to feed in these waters, and they were displaying that they had been feeding just a few hours before. And so for me, they broke the stereotypes.
So is it really that distinct that when they are mating in one part of the ocean, they're literally fasting? They're not eating and pooping as they would in feeding grounds? It's that distinct?
In most cases, yes. I mean, it is quite incredible when you think about it. They gorge, right? They go into covert, say the Antarctic, and they feed and feed and feed and feed. It's like dedicated feeding right there. And then they just basically, their whole mission then is to get safely to a birthing area and then give birth, make sure the calves are, you know, strong enough, old enough, and then do this massive migration back. And so you'll often see females or mothers getting skinnier as their babies get fatter because they're basically just feeding every, you know, their babies and their calves, and they're just losing all their body mass as a result. It's a massive sacrifice, and it's quite an incredible thing.
Wow. Asha DeVos, you study these blue whales that you call the unorthodox whales. Their population, their behavior is different. Do you still think there are broader lessons about whales, their ecosystem importance, their broader importance that we can still take away from your work on the blue whales?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they are ecosystem engineers. They function and provide this really important service to us, okay? And I think we need to start thinking about the word service. We talk about ecosystem services. Why is it that these ecosystems have to serve us, you know? We should be also looking at it as mutual. And we're not. We go all out and ransack, and then these systems are still expected to serve us. But, you know, the kind of work I do is really all focused on conservation and protecting these species in their waters.
with in consideration of all the livelihoods and stakeholders that are involved, right? So one of the big things that I address and I've been working on for years in Sri Lanka is how to stop these whales from getting hit by ships and getting killed. That's the number one threat to these whales in those waters.
And here in New England as well, that's one of the top two threats.
Absolutely. Yep, exactly. And so for us, you know, trying to understand, like I'm trying really hard to show people that every time we lose a whale, it affects our economy because now we've got this thriving whale watch tourism that's going on along our coastline that depends on blue whales, right? And it's trying to draw those connections with people, for people to understand that you can't make money off something if you're not going to look after it. I definitely think these animals provide a service not just in the ecosystem, but also to the survival and livelihoods of loads of human beings. And we need to take that into consideration.
Asha DeVos is the founding executive director of Ocean Swell. Asha, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.